I guess it's almost afternoon, but good morning, everybody. It's good to be here again to visit with everybody. Danielle and the girls are here this weekend. It's good to see Cyrus and Rebecca. It's been a while, so is this your first weekend back? It's been a little bit. It's good to see you guys. So it's been a while to see everybody, so it's good to be here. We can't say that God doesn't have a sense of humor. This morning, nobody else would have noticed except Bill and Laura and myself, but we were talking about songs for this the third meeting yesterday, and I said, anything but Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. And I said, just because it seems like it's a Cherrydale song, it always comes up, I said, let's do anything but that. So the first song called this morning was Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing in the 9 o'clock meeting. So I started laughing. And Bill, after I had brought that song up last night, Bill said, oh yeah, and 128. Let's do something other than that. So a little bit further on, Daniel. There it came, 128. So that's God's way of saying, if I want it sung, I'll have it sung. So I was just laughing at that. So, what I want to share about this today is really it's kind of a report on what God has been doing in Cuba. There's both myself, and then there's also been a gift given every month from Cherrydale for really the last over a year now. And so it seemed good to give a report. And then as we talked about it and I prayed about it, I also felt that it would be good to try to give some testimonial background on how I got involved and how the Lord kind of gave me witness of something about the work in Cuba as compared to the conditions here in the U.S. And so I want to tell a little bit of a personal testimony of what happened in getting involved in the ministry in Cuba. My involvement's very small, but what God is doing there is pretty amazing right now, and you'll get to hear a little bit about that. I think in sharing this story, it really is a story of how God works, and I think I wanted to give kind of two little phrases that would encapsulate what I've seen. One is that God is a master weaver, but he does it he does it in plain sight, but he does it invisibly at the same time. And I've heard some famous examples of, like, Corrie ten Boom. She uses a beautiful weaving, and she shows the back side of it, and then she flips it over and shows the beautiful weaving that's finished when you look at the front of it. And that many of our lives look like the backside of a weaving. It's all a mess. But when you get to see it in the end, it's all revealed. It's pretty amazing to see what God is doing as a master weaver. And he does it in plain sight, but it's still kind of an invisible process that you don't necessarily see all the details, or you don't realize what he's doing. The other is just the story of God as being the ultimate resource manager, knowing how to coordinate all kinds of details without necessarily having all men all coordinated where they know exactly what's happening. God is doing all the coordination. And then you look at the whole picture of what he accomplishes and you go, wow, look at what God is doing. And it's only credit to God. We're in our stewardship at times, we get involved in it, but it's really God doing the work from beginning to end and, you know, orchestrating all the details, and it's pretty amazing. Fred and Ann Malier, Fred has come and shared here a few times. They've moved to the Washington State area, but that's really part of where the story starts. I wanted to give a little bit of background, and I'll come back to that. And Fred, his testimony really is how his whole testimony for his whole life is how God has always been the person that has given the resources for every single thing he's done in each step of his life. And to some extent culminating in what has happened in Cuba. That's really, as I've spoken with him, he's felt that that's been really the place where the Lord's really blessed his work, as opposed to always being a struggle. It's been something that the Lord just kept blessing and kept blessing. And Fred has always seen God working as coordinating all the resources, and that's kind of something he sees as his theme for his life, his testimony. The story I have to tell to kind of share about becoming more involved in what's going on in Cuba is really a story of two men not myself, not Fred, but two other men that are really representative of two countries. One is the United States and one is Cuba. I'm not going to make a political discussion. It's really just a picture of two different men in two different societies. So it's not a political discussion. It's just about God and the conditions, the way he sees things sometimes. There's similarities and differences between these two men. One of these men is my uncle, and I'll tell you a little bit about him. The other man is Ledesma, who is in Cuba, and he shared here, I guess, just once before. Is it twice?
I think it's twice. Shared once in my house, and
that's right.
Here.
So those are the two men I'm going to talk about, and I'm tell you a story about a trip that I took to Florida and saw both of them, and kind of the story that the Lord kind of showed to me on that trip. There's similarities and differences between these two men. Both of them served in government. Ledesma served pretty high up in the Cuban government. My uncle served in the Senate, the White House, and other branches of the government for, I think, about 35 years total. He was involved in various different types of things, some very interesting things and some more mundane. But he was kind of more of a staff person on Senate staff in the White House. But he had a lot of involvement in different times, different certain situations. They were both successful in government service. Ledesma, he didn't share this when he was here, but what Ledesma was in the Cuban government was he was over the youth program, which I find that to be kind of humorous, that his goal was to recruit people into communism. Now he recruits people into the body of Christ. And so I find that the Lord just really has, you know, flipped his life to where, you know, what he... the natural skills he had in recruiting youth and in drawing people into a belief system, God is using those for his purpose, even though it was set out to begin with to be used for the purpose of drawing people into the Communist Party in Cuba. Both these men are ministers of God. My uncle was an Episcopalian minister. Years ago, that was his first thing that he did, was he was an Episcopalian minister. Something happened that nobody knows what it is, and he just walked away. And he went back and got some additional education, and he ended up in government service for the rest of his life, or the rest of his career. He's still alive today. So he had a title as an Episcopalian minister. Ledesma is functioning as a minister of God and has been since his conversion, and he continues to be very fruitful in how God has placed him. So both of these men, actually...
Matt, can you move your mic up a little bit?
Sure.
Here?
Is that better? Okay. Another similarity and differences. One is poor and one is rich. And I'll let you kind of decide which one is which. And actually, they're both poor and both rich. And you'll hear, as I go through the story, you'll hear some of both. And you'll kind of see that. I believe, I know Ledesma is a believer. I believe my uncle is actually a believer. I've had some discussion. It's hard to know for sure. If he is a believer, he's a very, very weak believer. But one of them, I would say, is a strong believer. One's a weak believer. But I believe they're both believers. My uncle may not be, but from the discussions and just the sense that I've had, I feel that he probably is, but he's very weak one. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And so the starting point I'm going to personalize it a little bit. The starting point is for me, back in when I was still here at Cherrydale, my previous employment, I saw that it was coming to an end, and I knew it was coming to an end. And so I had a pretty major transition in my life. Not an unfamiliar one. I've had a lot of job transitions. I've worked in... I counted it up, and I think I've worked in over 20 companies over a course of about 18 years. Now, some of those companies I spent 6 months, some I spent 2, 3, 5 years, different lengths of time. So I got kind of accustomed to the Lord leading me from one place to the next. And so I learned how to, in making those transitions, cross what I call an invisible bridge, which is you don't know how to get to the other side, but you have to start walking. And then you see the chasm open up, and you have to keep walking, and you have to keep looking to the Lord until you get across. And I've learned how to be less fearful in those transitions. I can't say that I don't have fear because it happens every time. It's like, yeah. I can remember a time that I was in one job, and I went to work one day, and I knew that was the last day at that job. I was contracting at a company and got called into an office and said, okay, your time's up here. But I had known at the beginning of the day it was over that day. And so I said, okay, Lord, what's next? So as soon as that meeting was over, I walked back to my office, and my phone rang. And somebody that I had never spoken to before said, I have a job, and it starts tomorrow. Can you be there? And that's the most outstanding example I have of transitions, which, you know, but it literally happened just like that. And so on Friday, I stopped one job, and on Monday, I was in another city starting another job. And the person who called me, he said, I was recommended that I call you by thus-and-so, this other person. And he said, if you're available, he said, it needs to start on Monday. It can't start any later. So I didn't have to hesitate. I just said, I'll be there, because God had ended my other job just a few minutes before. And I've had a number of transitions. I wouldn't say any that are quite as dramatic, but where God has made it clear, I'm leaving one thing and I'm going to the next. In this most recent time, really transitioning from the D.C. area down to Charlottesville with my family, it took longer. It was between the two jobs. It was, you know, roughly 6 months. There really wasn't, I realized as I was looking at this, I didn't have a gap in work, because it turned out that the Lord provided work through Philip here, Philip Lester, that there was some contract work. So in all the transition of the savings, because the Lord had directed me 2 to 3 years before just to save money. Don't think about it, just save. And so then it turned out that in the transition, 6 months worth of unemployment, quote unquote unemployment, I calculated and figured out I only really spent about $8,000 out of savings. That was over a 6 month period to have everything covered. I never failed to have health insurance. Never. So God was faithful in all of that transition. And the other thing that happened was the story that the Lord was putting in front of me, and also really getting more involved with what was happening in Cuba. Because at the beginning of this transition, the Lord kind of put it on my heart to go visit Fred and Ann. And so I went down to visit them. And one of the subjects was Cuba, because I had already been talking to Fred about a lot of his little books, because I was helping him move them onto the computer, and or on a new format on the computer. And we began to talk, and we decided during that discussion that we should go visit with Ledesma, because he was going to be in the U.S. for a short period of time. We didn't have the only plan we had in it was just for me to meet him and to make notes about kind of Fred's story in Cuba. God had other plans in the process, but that's what got us started down that path. And so we arranged this trip, and the trip ended up, at the same time, the other thing that had happened was my uncle had lived here in the D.C. area for, I guess, close to 35, almost 40 years, and he had just recently moved to Florida, to Naples, Florida, which is kind of on the opposite coast from Miami. So I had gotten to know my uncle here in D.C. for the first time. I had never met him before we moved to D.C. He was reclusive. He didn't keep contact with the rest of the family. My dad doesn't. I know my uncle better than my father does, his own brother, because they don't speak. And it's not out of any problem. Just kind of, he's just a recluse, kind of a closed off type of person. If you know his history, you can come to understand why, some of his involvements he had in the government. But he doesn't really relate to any other family member. He also doesn't relate to his own son. His own son departed and has not been in contact with him. So he's basically off by himself. And so I decided that it would be good to go visit him. So my trip to Florida, I would drive to Miami. I would pick up Fred at the airport. We would drive on down to Homestead, which is just south of Miami, spend some time there, and then we'd drive across to, after taking Fred back to the airport and he flew home, drive across to Naples, Florida, and visit my uncle for a number of days, and then drive home. And on the drive home, I stopped and saw Andy Anderson in Asheville, and then ended up back at home here in D.C. So on this trip, when we got to Ledesma, it was actually Ledesma, his wife, his daughter, her children. So it's kind of the whole family, with the exception of one other daughter that's in Cuba. We had 3 days of, I would say, the most intense fellowship that I've ever experienced in my life. There's a few other times I've had intense fellowship, but we had 3 days worth of just real communication. And I don't know how to say it a different way. It's when there's heart-level communication, where there are things that are being spoken to your heart as you're talking with another person, where God is speaking, and there's just all kinds of communication happening. One example would be Ledesma's granddaughter. She's at the time she's 17. She had never really understood why her grandfather had left the communist government. She had never really heard his story. It didn't make sense to her. And while we were there, I told a testimonial story from my own past of not finishing college and how I had felt led not to finish university and get a degree. And that struck her, and she heard the story being told, and she couldn't understand it. And she ended up asking her grandfather, how could a man give up everything, their future? Because if you don't have a degree, how are you going to be successful in America? How could you do that knowing that it could be consequences? And part of my testimony was there had been no consequences. I'd actually been blessed, and I have been in my career. I've been extremely blessed. I've gotten to do things that most people, even when they try really hard, can't get access to. That's how God is when you follow Him. Telling my story, Shabelis is her name. She was very curious about this, so she asked her grandfather. She ended up understanding what I had to share, but she also understood her grandfather. She came to a full understanding of what, and she came back and said that's the first time she had a real understanding of why her grandfather had left the communist government and why he had chosen to go a path that basically meant that he would be ostracized by society. And so that's when I talk about communication. I mean, there was just the Lord was speaking in every direction to every person that was there, me included. And Fred also gave witness and said that was one of the most intense 3 days he's ever had of just fellowship with the Lord. The way that I took it at the time was this was just the Lord saying, I want the three of you together. I want you talking and communicating. And this is something I'm putting my stamp on this. And I've had that experience before where the Lord is certifying or putting His stamp on something just by the presence of His Spirit saying, this is me. And that's the way I took it. But we had just, like I said, really good fellowship for three days, 2 different languages. We had to go through Fred because I don't speak Spanish and Ledesma doesn't speak English. But we had real communication and real fellowship. One of the things Ledesma said while I was there, he actually reiterated 3 or 4 times. He says, I left the government. He said, I have no retirement. He said, I have no security. He said, and I have no money, really. He said, but I am a wealthy man. And he said, because of all the things God has done in his life, I do have a retirement in reality. He said, I can't see it and I can't put my hands on it. He said, I know that the Lord has supplied for me and will supply for me. And he was just giving witness to, and he said, I have a legacy that's not, he said, it's not something that's that other men look at necessarily, he said, but it's a spiritual one. And he said, I have a lot in that way. And he said, and I realized that what I gave up was so far less than what I achieved. And so that was, there was a lot of different things we spoke about, but that was one thing that really came through, that he knew that even though he had, what he did when he left the government was he turned over all of his credentials. He had a law degree, an economics degree. He actually had an economics degree given to him from a Russian university in Russia. And he took all of his certifications, all of his credentials, and he gave them back to the government. He said, these are not, basically, I don't need any of these anymore. And he wasn't being proud. He just knew this was the end of that life. The result of that was the government basically said, well, you're not going to be employable. And they blacklisted him to where no employer would employ him. So the only thing he had was the car that they had left him with. And so he became a taxi driver. And that's how his, that was his transition into ministry, was the Lord made minimal provision for he and his family to drive the car that the government had left him with. He actually drove ex-officials that he, or officials that he used to work with, he drove them around and they would laugh at him for basically, this is what you now do instead of serving in the government. So I left this, you know, spiritually intense time in Homestead with Ledesma and his whole family, and I traveled across to Naples, Florida, to visit with. Oh, I do. There's one other thing I do need to add on that. I shall save that later. I'm sorry. I traveled across to see my uncle, and got there, and we had a very good visit. He's not spoken to really anybody about a lot of the things that he used to do in the government. He just kind of, he keeps, like I said, he's a reclusive person. But what happened while I was there was Ted Kennedy died. And we were watching it on TV. And he and I were talking about things, and he saw it happen, and I could see it. It really hit him. I didn't understand at first, and he sat there for a couple of minutes, and then he just started talking. Turns out that he served under Ted Kennedy for 5 or 6 years in his office as a staffer. So he was pretty close with Ted Kennedy and his family. He worked in multiple different senators' offices over the years, but he knew Ted Kennedy very well. And so it was a personal thing for him. He actually got a call, invited to come up to the funeral during the time I was there. He decided not to go, but it opened him up, and he just started talking. And he started talking about many of the things that he had done in the government over the years. And he just started telling story after story, and which is, you know, only God can do that. But it was in response to what had happened, and I just happened to be there. And he was very thankful. He said, "I'm glad that you were here for this," he said, "because I wouldn't have been able to handle this well if I'd been by myself." He said, "because Ted was really an important person in my life that really helped me." Now, if he was in Ted's office, you know, he was a Democrat. My uncle was a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat, and he was more of a social justice type of person. He helped with the Native Indian affairs, with trying to do reconciliation in the West, and he actually worked with Robert Kennedy on that, and he was one of the point people to help set up a lot of those programs. He helped with setting up more Medicare, Medicaid, a lot of things. A lot of us would be like, "No, don't do that. No more government." But he—that was still his—that was his belief. He believed in making a better world through better government, and he served in, you know, the most powerful government in the world to be able to advance the causes of men among men. And the other thing that he started sharing, and he started pulling out all of his things that he had kept. He pulled out all the Nixon materials. He had 4 boxes worth of Nixon materials. And so it turned, and then he said, "I have all these because," he said, "I worked for 6 to 9 months to get 75 senators together so that we could start the Nixon trials." He said, "because we didn't know how to stop the man." He said, "we were very, very concerned that he was going to do very dangerous things in the government." And so it was, and I've gone back. I didn't fully believe what he told me, but I went back and verified it. What happened was he was able to get a whole group of senators together, and they all theorized, "What can we do to slow Nixon down? Because he's doing things behind the scenes that are very dangerous." And he shared some of them with me, which I won't repeat, because some of the things that Nixon was up to were just very scary, behind the scenes type stuff. So in getting these senators together, they realized the only power they had as the Senate was to call a hearing. And so with all the work my uncle had done, when it came to open the hearing, the senator he was working for, who had authorized him to do all this background work, actually brought him to the front of the line of all the senators. And every time you open a Senate hearing, there's a procession. They do a ceremonial entrance of the senators. It's not the one you see on TV. It's before that. It's an official ceremonial opening of each hearing. And they all walk in order of precedence as far as their ranking within the Senate. And so they put him up in front just to honor him for all the work he had done. So I actually found the archive tapes on PBS that, sure enough, there's my uncle walking through the door in front of all the senators. And that was just their way of saying thank you for all the work he had done to help bring about the Nixon hearings. And so it's something I never knew, and it's kind of an amazing little story. But it just gives you a picture that he got to do a lot of interesting things. This is all after being an Episcopalian minister. And as we talked, we began to be able to try to talk about God a little bit. And I'd say pretty much as we broached the subject of God at all, he just shut down. And he finally shut down, and so I just let it be. And he came back to me about a day later, and he said, "I can't talk about God." He said, I know I believe in things, and I know that there's a God, and I actually would say I would believe in a Jesus. He said, but I cannot talk about it. I cannot handle it. It affects me too badly. He said, I can't talk about it. He said, that's it. He said, so I apologize to you. He said, it's just a subject I can't even enter into. And that was fine with me, but I had been this contrast between meeting Ledesma and spending a time of intense fellowship, and then I'd go to visit my uncle, and it's such a strong contrast between the two. I left there, and I went to visit Andy, and as I was driving to visit Andy, I was thinking to myself, whoa, what was this? Or what? Such a strong difference, and it just struck me, it's like, what was that? I didn't have I had a long drive, but I didn't think about it a whole lot. I got to visit Andy, and Andy was ready to engage. There was a subject that he and I had talked about. Ready to engage. The subject that there was one subject that he and I had talked about on several occasions, and I had always resisted him on the subject. I had always said no, and not that I completely disagreed with him, but that there was I saw another aspect, which Andy was laser focused on a different point of view. The subject was the seven churches in Revelation. And the seven churches in Revelation, Andy's point of view, which I don't completely disagree with, but because of my personal background and history, I hold it a little more loosely than Andy does. And Andy's view, and I think a lot of people share this view, that the seven churches are a historical progression over time of the history of the church. And that there's various nuances to it, but you go through the progression through these churches and you match it up against history. And the thing I had said to Andy in response is, I said, be careful about fables and genealogies. I said, I know that there's truth in what you're saying. I said, but don't lock in too closely. I said, because you can say, okay, here's this progression, and this maps to this, and this maps to this. I said, but then you can find how God worked in some other part of the world at the same time. How does that fit in? And Andy said, well, if you don't believe that, then what's any other view? And so I gave him a view that, just a different view that I had seen at some point. And in simple form, it's just that at any given time within a country or within an area, you'll see these seven different conditions of different churches that are representatively shown in Revelation. And so I didn't cast aside Andy's view, but he wanted to go through it in detail, so we did, and I was happy to. But we walked through every one of the seven churches, one, two, and he was showing me details and things that there was actually a couple of things he showed me leading up to the story of the seven churches that gave me some light that I hadn't previously seen. So it was good fellowship, but I mean, he was just ready to engage, and it's like that was the topic, and that's what we were going to talk about. So then I left there. And now I'm scratching my head further going, what is all this? Because and I actually started asking the Lord. I said, what is this? And so I actually had one more stop. I stopped by the Maliers because it was on the way to come back through Lynchburg and then up to D.C. And I kind of told them, because Fred had been down in Homestead with me. I told him about my visit with my uncle, visiting Andy. And I said, it seems pretty, everything that happened is, it's very, in each direction, kind of intense. And I said, I don't know if God's saying something to me or not. I said, but I just, it's kind of striking me. What is all this? And nothing. So I left there. And as I drove home, it began to occur to me. And what came to my mind was Philadelphia and Laodicea. And that's what the Lord started bringing to mind, because Andy and I just read through it. And I'll read you the... And don't take, this is not a, what I'm going to share next, it's not a condemnation, it's not an accusation, you know, it's not pointing a finger at anyone. What the Lord was showing me, and it was for me to understand, you know, to see a picture, was to understand the environmental conditions here in the U.S. versus the environmental conditions in Cuba. And let me... So to the church in Philadelphia, it's Revelations 3:7-13, says, "And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, the words of the Holy One, the true One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one will and no one opens. I know your works. Behold, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and not denied my name. Behold, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them come down and bow down before your feet, and they will learn that I have loved you. Because you have kept my word of patience, patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to try those who dwell on the earth. I am coming soon. Hold fast what you have, so no one may seize your crown. The one who conquers, or the overcomer, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. Never shall he go out of it, and I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down from my God out of heaven, and my own new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." One piece of Ledesma's testimony that really struck a chord was, as he was exiting the government, he was called into a meeting, and the prayer he had, even before he knew these verses, but the prayer that was in him was, "Don't let me deny you." He said that's the only thing I knew was I didn't want to deny the Lord. He said I didn't know what was going to be asked. I didn't know what was going to come up. And he said, but that was just the only thing in me was, you know, let me be faithful, at least not deny you. And he successfully got through that time with the government. They were questioning him. What are you doing now? What is this conversion thing? What are you going to go off and do? Are you a threat to the government? That's really the question they were asking. And so he was able to go through that questioning, and he never denied the Lord, and he did actually proclaim that he had come to know the Lord. And so they did leave him alone, but that just rung true out of the church in Philadelphia. And the other thing that rang true was, you're not very powerful, meaning you don't have many resources, you don't have a lot of ability. And in juxtaposition with the church in Laodicea. And I'll just read this next. I don't have a lot of time left. I'm going to speed up a little bit because I want to share a little bit more. It says, "And to the angel of the church in Laodicea write, the words of the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of God's creation. I know your works. You are neither hot nor cold. I would that you were either hot or cold. So because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. For you say, I am rich, I have prospered, and I need nothing, not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel to you to buy gold from me refined by fire, so that you may be rich, and white garments, so that you may clothe yourself and see the shame and the shame of your nakedness and may not be seen, and salve to anoint your eyes, so that you may see. Those whom I love, I reprove and discipline. So be zealous and repent. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him, and he with me. To the one who overcomes, I will grant him to sit with me on my throne, as I also conquered and sat with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." I know this is, for me anyway, and it's a broad generalization. It's not a specific each individual church. But I know America is more in this condition. We have tons of knowledge. We have tons of money. We have all kinds of resources to say we're in a good place as Christians and just practically speaking. And this is what the Lord was bringing to mind. These are the two conditions. And then what he brought to mind was, I showed you two men, one from each. And they're both products of their environment. And how different it is to become a Christian, that the process in Cuba, and this is what happens, there's a lot of maturing and growth that happens with believers in Cuba, just naturally, because their environment is so different. And I'll start telling you a little bit about the conditions there as far as the church. They don't really think about which church you're a part of or whether you're in. I mean, there's discussion about Catholicism and denominations, but the way they work the ministry there is across the different denominations, because it's whoever is interested in helping you to advance the gospel there. They work as a network together. And this is what's happening now in Cuba, and they've started a project of evangelizing over the last several years. And they have quite a few workers there that are going out door to door, literally. They have over 100 people, ministers that are, and I don't mean minister that they've necessarily gone to college, some of them have, but that are full-time workers, and they live off of, they go in the biblical sense that they go with nothing, because they get help along the way, because they really don't have the ability to have lots of resources. And they've continued to evangelize there. Here, it's the juxtaposition that the Lord was making in my mind was just very, very strong between the difference in the conditions of the environment of the church in the two different locations. This is how the Lord brought me into helping in Cuba, and the emphasis He put in my mind, not that I'm supposed to go to Cuba, not that I'm supposed to do something different in some major way. I live here. And that's the other thing the Lord pointed out in these verses was, it says, to him who's in that location, if you're in Philadelphia, it tells you how to overcome. If you're in Laodicea, it tells you how to overcome there. So I'm not supposed to pick up and move to Cuba or somewhere else, at least not for me. Some people do feel led to go places. But I can overcome where I am. And that's what the Lord was pointing out to me, was you can overcome right where you are. You can look to the Lord and say, how do I buy gold or find by, you know, fire? Now, I don't really want to ask that question, but that's what the need is, because nobody really wants to be tested with fire. But that's what the Lord was showing to me, is that that's the condition that I'm in, and that's where I am. But He was also showing my brothers in another place who I could help. And that's what I felt led to start giving tithe money there, and I've been doing that pretty much since we left, around that same time of starting to move down to Charlottesville. And so what's happened since then, it's not anything to my credit. I'd say it's Fred. You know, Fred has done a tremendous amount of work there, as has Ledesma, but the Lord has really begun to bless things. And so, briefly, what I want to tell you about is that since they started the evangelization project in 2000, I think it was 10 or 11, I think in 2011, I think Bill may have shared this here, there was about 1,100 or 1,200 saved in the different provinces. The first half of this year, we got an email, Fred and I got an email just recently, that there's been upwards of 4,000 conversions just in the first half of this year across two-thirds of the provinces. That's about, they kind of keep up with the numbers, so Ledesma has a government background, he knows how to track things, so they keep up with how many people are going out. They know they've evangelized about 25,000 people, and of those, 4,000 have been saved. And it's somewhat regularly happening now that they'll organize an open-air meeting or in a church setting, which they always have to get permission from the government. But there will be, you know, 10, 20, or even over 100. I think the 15th of June, they had an open-air meeting. About 400 attended, and 120 were saved. And it's not a numbers game, but it's just, you can see that the Lord is moving and working. What they do there is they simply go door-to-door as sharing the gospel, and they hand out tracts. They come back as they share the gospel, and they if someone's interested, they keep discussing and fellowshipping with them, and they'll invite them to a meeting, or they'll just spend time with them in their home. And so you can't have meetings in Cuba of more than 14 people without permission from the government or to have it organized. So everything is very much small home church settings. And so they've been, they go back and they're basically planting little house churches all over the place. One city they went into, they preached to 3,500 people and 2,000 of them were saved. So that literally, and I just wanted to draw the, I was just stunned as I was reading this because, like I said, they're realizing that the Lord's just starting to pour out, on them something that's just pretty amazing. And so, you know, in a matter of just a couple of months there, they had roughly 20 Cherrydales suddenly bloom in one city. I mean, as far as just the, and so they have tremendous need that's now is coming from just the fact that they have a whole bunch of new converted Christians that now they have to minister to try to help them grow. So the report that's, is, it's pretty amazing what's happening there. And Fred has said to myself, and he said it to Bill and others, which is, you know, you get the best bang for the buck in Cuba. He said, because, and here's the, they spend about 2 cents per tract. They spend 50 cents for a New Testament. The Canadian Bible Society actually delivers free New Testaments and Bibles, and then they just pay the tax. And that's the money that comes, right now comes from the U.S., is just to buy New Testaments and full Bibles. And so as many as they get now, they're giving them out as quickly as they can. I mean, they just disappear. So they pay 50 cents for a New Testament, and they pay about 70 or 80 cents for a full Bible. And so they have to be very disciplined about how they distribute them, because that's all they only have a certain amount that they get every period of time. So the report from Cuba is pretty amazing what God is doing right now. And I wanted to share it because there's money that comes from Cherrydale every month that helps with this ministry. And you know, the need is always greater than the supply in a lot of cases, you know, at least from our point of view. God sees it at this point that this is what he's provided, and it's been sufficient, and he's blessing it tremendously. But there's an ongoing need, and it's growing, and they continue to have, they intend to have all 15 provinces being fully evangelized, meaning going, and they go city to city, by the end of this year. And so they're going to continue to, they go city by city, the largest city to the smaller, so they'll keep working each territory. So they're extremely diligent in what they're doing at this point. And they feel that they just need to keep pursuing that. And the Lord is providing for them, you know, is, along the way. I think the only other comment I wanted to make to kind of close is just, you know, I thought about this, and it's like, you know, the gospel doesn't work here like that. We don't typically see that kind of growth happening here. And there's reasons. I mean, there's a lot of reasons for that. And I think the Laodicean condition helps to paint a picture of that. We have lots of distractions, lots of things that can draw our attention away. And it's just harder to hear the gospel because we don't have the need like they do. Because they do have problems with food supply. They have, you know, we've just recently experienced power outage. They don't have consistent power almost any time. It's daily outages, and even in Havana, are the norm, with the exception of maybe the government buildings. So they understand the need for God much more simply than we do. It takes a lot more for us to get through all the, you know, we have kind of safety and security naturally from our environment, much more so than you do in an environment like Cuba. And that's true of a lot of third world countries. Cuba's not completely special in that regard, but it's, you know, here it's much harder. There's a lot more filters. There's a lot more blindness that we have in seeing the Lord and in hearing the gospel. I wanted to open, are there any, we're at the end, but I wanted to ask if there were any questions just as far as what's going on in Cuba or anything else. And I didn't have a well-organized conclusion to what I was going to share. I just wanted to share kind of the testimony and then what the Lord is doing right now in Cuba, and just that the need is an ongoing need there to help. So I don't have an amazing conclusion to what I'm going to share. But I wanted to open for any questions, if there were any.
How is Fred, and is he able to go back to Cuba and be in New Jersey?
No, Fred is, he won't be traveling anymore. Since you've asked, so Fred is basically handed off all of his ministry efforts because he felt like the Lord just said, it's time to, you've finished running. And that's the way he told it to me, which is it's time to pass the baton. And that was part of what happened on this trip, was I knew coming out of this trip, I knew the Lord was saying to me, I'm getting ready to give you some responsibility. It didn't happen for a little while, but I knew walking away from this trip that it was occurring. And so about a year or so later, Fred contacted me in email and basically said, I know it's time to pass the baton, and I know that I'm to contact you. So he's there in Washington State it's a retirement community, but they're still in unassisted living, so they're not in any kind of assisted setting at this point. And he's having ministry to those that are there at the retirement community. So that's where he won't be traveling there again, for he doesn't plan to. Yeah.
What kind of follow up is there with the new conference down there, 1,000 and small churches planted, and you've had that all?
Because they don't have, so without building a whole church, everything is home groups basically. So they have home groups that'll be 5 to 14, and the max being 14. they have a government limit on that. So they go back and visit, and that's one of the things now. It becomes challenging when you have that many settings. So they go back and revisit as much as they can, and they see who's growing, and that's who they give more materials to, and they try to work with them. But it's basically that they have tons of small groups in these various cities and whatnot. And so that's the best they're able to do simply because of resources. If there's not any other questions, that's what I had to share. I hope that it wasn't terrible. I hope it was somewhat interesting. So be praying for Cuba. Be praying that God would continue to be the ultimate manager of the whole process. When I mentioned earlier that God's using Canada to supply Bibles through a certain small number of people, He's using money from the U.S., He's using all these different little pieces. We don't know about each other. They're just different directions, and they all end up where God has, where there's the need. And so God is giving the supply, but with the growth, there's just, I'm publishing the need, that there really is a strong need to help there, and there's not a lot of avenues they get for help. The one that we've found and the way we've established it, it's all completely legal, both for the U.S. and for Cuba. So we've been able to sort out exactly how to do it so that nobody gets in trouble in any direction, and it's all within the legal framework. I actually talked to the State Department in making sure how exactly I can do things. And so it's all completely, it's not having to be done under the covers from a governmental perspective.
Can you imagine here, you preach to 3,500 people, 2,000 get saved?
Yep.
People just don't feel the need here. I don't need God, I've got everything I need.
Right. So I'm just going to pray a little bit for Cuba, pray for Ledesma. Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for the opportunity to share some of what you're doing in Cuba and how you're continuing to care for the church there, the whole church there. And even though they are not equipped with tremendous resources, they have you and they have your word, they have your spirit, and that you would continue to care for each one of them in growing in you and in spreading your word to others around them, and that you would just continue to grow and care for the church in Cuba as a whole, and keep protection, that the enemy doesn't have a way to affect the work that you continue to do. And just we bind the enemy back and hold him back in any of his efforts. And we just agree with you that you should continue to save all of those who you've called, and that they would hear the word and that they would receive it. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.